It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Beyond the bowler hats and classic British stoicism, most of us know the broad strokes of the life and times of Winston Churchill. But the partner who bolstered him through triumph, failure, and many faces of his own ambition is arguably lesser known. Pittsburgh author Marie Benedict has imagined quite the inner life for Lady Clementine Churchill, filling in the gaps overlooked by the history books. She's the focus of a new work of historical fiction published earlier this year. The Confluence's Megan Harris spoke to Benedict just after its release.
This is your fourth work of historical fiction. Three are real people: physicist Mileva Marish Einstein, actress Hedy Lamarr, and now the indomitable Clementine. What drew you to her story?
Wow. I mean, to be honest, I keep a laundry list of incredible historical women that I want to write about, and I find them literally everywhere. These women are hiding in plain sight, just waiting for us to discover them. Clementine, I found when I was kind of knee-deep in historical research about my prior book, The Only Woman in the Room, which, as you mentioned, is about the actress Hedy Lamarr, but is really very much a World War II story. So I was really knee-deep in this historical research. And of course, who do you keep bumping into when you're in World War II space? It's Winston Churchill, you know, the ubiquitous cigar, the hat, the V for Victory sign. And, you know, I'm not a Churchillian, as people who are big Winston Churchill fans call themselves, but I did know that he had a really long marriage, decades long. And I kept wondering, where is she? You know, he is arguably present at most of the key events sort of during this time period. And I kept on wondering where she was, what she was like, what she was doing during these really pivotal points. And when I dug into the research, I found out that she was so much more incredible than I could have ever imagined.
Of all your characters, Clementine kind of struck me as especially introspective. She questions herself, her actions, her thoughts on almost every page of the book. Was she as prone to that in real life from what you could tell?
Absolutely. I mean, she, you know, Winston is really known as suffering from this mental health condition of depression. He called it his black dog. I'm sure you probably heard that phrase.
Yeah.
But Clementine was actually the one who I think struggled more. She didn't struggle from depression, but really crippling anxiety sometimes. And she learned throughout the course of their very long marriage that she really needed to take what was called during the time rest cures. We'd probably call them mental health breaks today. But she needed to get distance really from him as a corollary, their family and their children.
Yeah.
But from him in order to really serve in the capacity as his wife and political partner, which is really what she was.
And Winston Churchill was known for being kind of, he was raving. He had highs, he had lows, and he demanded a lot of the people in his inner circle. How did your research into their marriage reveal maybe more than you thought you would find there?
Wow. I mean, I think first, two things, really. I think the thing that knitted them together from the start, from the very first time they met at a dinner party in March of 1908, was their shared passion for politics. They both really loved both liberal politics at that time and the idea that they could do good in their world, really make a difference. And Clementine had been engaged twice before, not unusual for the time period. And she knew she needed a partner that could really match her in her intellect and her passions. So I think she, in some ways, she thought she knew what she was getting into when she married him. But he, once they were married and they returned from their honeymoon, really from the day they stepped back on British soil, he involved her in his political world in a way that was really unprecedented for the time. And so she must have been, had not anticipated that to some extent. But once he kind of, raised the bar, she really rose to it. And she became his political partner in whatever capacity he was serving, you know, whether it was Home Secretary, Lord Admiral in the early years of their marriage. And then later, when he had, you know, been ousted from power and then reclaimed power during the World War II years as a prime minister's wife, she really stepped into that role like nobody had ever done so before.
And we should say their political alignment diverged a lot over the years. When they met as young people, they were both very liberal, both cared very deeply about social causes. He went farther and farther right over the years. How did that affect their relationship and their balance between home and work, or I guess I should say lack thereof?
Definitely lack thereof. Great question, though. I mean, I think there was definitely a moment and a crossroads when their marriage almost didn't continue during that time period. When she recommitted and came back to their marriage, she was really determined to find common ground. And where they found common ground was in securing Britain against the rise of the Nazis. And they really became perfectly aligned in that matter, if not any other.
And in your imagining, it seems like they're really craving the stability of a marriage that makes sense to them, that builds each other up both personally and professionally day by day.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, the unfortunate thing is the things that bonded them together, they came from a penniless background. They were both constantly, well, she especially was constantly moving. That didn't change during their marriage. Money was always an issue for them because they didn't come to the marriage with money.
And suddenly they're hosting galas and dinners and all these things where they have to order top-notch champagne for whoever's visiting the house.
Exactly. On a shoestring budget. With limited staff. I mean, we can't relate to that now because we don't have staff. But, she was running enormous governmental homes. So there was a lot of pressure in their world. But I think the idea that she could serve in a political sphere that otherwise would have been denied to her as a woman was very appealing. And it really made her rise to the occasion.
While also writing and editing all of his speeches and being available if he has a question or counseling
24/7.
Him on the most basic parts of diplomacy. How much do you think that that weighed on her spirit over time? You know, you paint this picture of a really ambitious but also incredibly patient behind-the-scenes leader. It's such a metamorphosis from where she starts, as you say, when they met in 1908 to where the book ends and just after VE Day in 1945.
Right, exactly. I think as she escalated step by step in her marriage and step by step in Winston's career, she took on more responsibilities. You know, as you mentioned, she edited and vetted his speeches, which people don't really realize. She helped advise on policy, staff matters. He was appalling in dealing with his staff, as, you know, as is rumored. And she undertook a variety of her own projects, which nobody invited her to do. She just kind of claimed that for herself.
It seems like the opposite. They didn't really want her in the room at all.
Probably. They would prefer she wasn't, but they realized that whatever his failings, Winston had utter faith in Clementine, and he wasn't going to allow anyone to stop him from inviting her into the political world that he inhabited.
Do you think that Winston would have been the figure that we know today had it not been for the influence of his wife?
Oh, absolutely not. She was not only important, she was integral.
So then why do you think he didn't give her that credit on a public stage? You know, he thrived on being well-known and well-liked.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think he withheld that from her?
You know, it's really a hard question. And I'm always that makes me angry that she wasn't given the public credit during her lifetime. And I'm always trying to put things in historical context. And I think during this time period, there were a lot of expectations about what women could do, but not a lot of acknowledgement and reward for what they did do. And I think a lot of that stems from historical preconceptions about women and their capabilities. And I think on some level, he knew that the rest of the world wouldn't really acknowledge that.
You've grown your literary profile over the course of your works. You've been on bestseller lists now and telling stories, as you say, of these overlooked women. What has the success of it all felt like for you?
I feel so delighted that these women are finally getting the platform that they deserve.
Is that vindicating?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's for every, you know, bestseller list that these books make, I just think of the numbers of people who are finally hearing these stories, who are finally, hopefully, not just thinking about World War II a little bit differently in the case of Lady Clementine or the technology that they use every day in the case of the only woman in the room, but really starting to look at the past differently themselves and wondering where the women are, wondering what their contributions were, and then extrapolating that into our everyday lives. You know, I think we need to really shift the lens at which the manner in which we look at our past and look at our present to really understand the breadth of women's contributions and capabilities.
Marie Benedict is a Pittsburgh author whose most recent work is Lady Clementine. It's about the life and times of Clementine Churchill. Marie, thanks so much for taking time.
Thank you, Megan.
That was The Confluence's Megan Harris. We caught up with Marie this week. She says recent sales of all four of her novels have been, quote, remarkable, and she feels really fortunate to be able to bring some level of comfort to readers during quarantine. Lady Clementine comes out in paperback July 7th. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Retail businesses throughout the Pittsburgh region are reopening. But after a couple of months with their doors closed, retailers that were already in trouble could be facing grim prospects. Reporter Tim Schooley of the Pittsburgh Business Times has been looking at three mainstays of the Pittsburgh retail scene. Tim, let's start with Dick's Sporting Goods. Its stock took a beating throughout March. The company closed all its stores for 2 weeks, laid off staff, and announced in April that it would not be able to pay its rent. Tim, where does Dick stand now?
I think it's helpful to know where these companies were before the pandemic hit. And Dick's was in a relatively strong position as the largest retailer of their kind. I suspect that will bode well for them coming out of this as they reopen stores and implement things like contactless pickup.
So their future is maybe not as murky as some others?
They've been relatively healthy, and they're the largest sporting goods retailer in the country at this point. I would expect they'll be poised to benefit as other sporting goods companies are really challenged more by this pandemic. Mm-hmm.
Has the company made a successful transition to online sales and delivery?
Certainly most of their sales are coming from their bricks and mortar stores, but they have been very proactive in shifting to e-commerce. I'm sure that will only continue to expand in the months and years ahead.
Another Pittsburgh-based company, GNC, it warned investors earlier this month that it might have to file for Chapter 11 bankruptcy if it can't renegotiate $700 million in debt. So what's the latest with GNC?
They just reported they had a $200 million quarterly loss a couple weeks ago, so I'd be surprised if they avoided Chapter 11.
Can the company carry that kind of a debt load?
That's a good question. I've never seen a quarterly loss of that size by any company in Pittsburgh, so we'll see what it takes to come up with financing in a world in which there's so much financial duress right now.
Tim, another locally based company, American Eagle Outfitters, laid off staff, suspended dividend programs for shareholders. How much trouble are they in?
American Eagle is another company that was pretty healthy going into this. They had differentiated themselves from other teen retailers that hadn't been able to make the shift to the kind of the fast fashion trends. They have a young clientele attuned to buying online.
So the online will help them out then?
Oh, for sure. I'm sure this whole event will change habits and further spur people to buy more of their product online.
Tim, do you think that smaller niche retailers, most without major debt, are maybe in a better position to make a comeback if they stay in business?
I would be a little wary of being any kind of retailer right now. We can have all the government announcements for openings that we want, but if people aren't comfortable going back, it's not going to make that much of a difference.
And what questions would you have for any of these three that we talked about? Dick's, American Eagle Outfitters, GNC.
How much are we going to see e-commerce become a majority portion of your sales as we go forward through this? What's the ceiling for how much you can sell online versus how much you have to sell in your stores? That's a different question for every product that they have. I'm sure that how customers view different merchandise is going to influence the way they view buying them online versus having to see it in person.
Tim Schooley covers the retail industry for the Pittsburgh Business Times. Thanks for your time, Tim.
Thank you very much.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pennsylvania small business owners trying to survive the shutdown have gotten used to a lot of paperwork. Government grants and loans can have daunting applications and long wait lines. But a new private grant program in Pennsylvania is offering a simpler, speedier option. It requires one thing that others don't, though, an on-camera pitch. Keystone Crossroads' Miles Bryan has been watching the tapes.
The video applications tend to start the same way.
Hi,
Hi, my name is Megan.
Hello, everyone. My name is Ethan.
Hello, guys. I am Sharina Tay.
Hey, folks. My name is Chef Jimmy.
The camera's trained on the owner, who's sitting in their bar or salon or living room. Their stories follow similar timelines. The shutdown in mid-March. The struggle to stay afloat since. You know how bad things are for many businesses, but the videos drive that home.
We do what we can for our community, but now our community can't support us.
Angie Vanney gives us a tour of her quiet Philly gift shop, Giggles Gifts.
Now we're looking at our Irish section. This usually is empty by the time St. Patrick's Day is over. It's stocked full because of the fear and the stay-at-home order.
The videos are submissions to a new grant program called the Pennsylvania 30-Day Fund. It offers up to $3,000 to small businesses in the state. The application is slim, and a decision comes in just a few days.
Here I am in my salon, walking up the steps. We're on the top floor, and
the videos also showcase small business owners' preparations for going back to work in a post-coronavirus world. Salon owner Cherie Latte filmed herself suited up in a surgical mask and plastic face shield.
This is going to be our new normal when the governor does allow us to come back, these face shields, which are pretty hard to breathe in, but giving it a go.
The 30-day fund grant is only available to businesses with 3 to 30 employees, and applicants often focus on what they're doing for the community past creating jobs or paying taxes. Prentice Boone runs Hote Barbershop in North Philly.
We do free haircuts for back to school. I cut over 400 kids for free for back to school haircut time. We do free haircuts for the homeless in the wintertime around Thanksgiving.
The fund was set up by Philly area business leaders. They've raised $300,000 to distribute so far. Co-founder Jeff Brown is a grocery store executive by day. He says sizing up a business's financials is the easy part.
A lot of these businesses are like pillars of their community, and they do things to help a community exist in profound ways you can't tell in writing. You have to see the person and see their business.
The fund has received over 750 applications from businesses and funded about 50, prioritizing those owned by women and people of color. Megan Benz is one of the business owners that's gotten funding. Her vegan bakery reopened for delivery and pickup in April, but revenue is way down. She's applied to about a dozen grants and loans, including the federal Paycheck Protection Program, but
it was just like a bunch of no's. And then I applied for the 30-day fund on a Thursday, and by Saturday morning, they were like, oh, we've selected you, and I was just shocked.
Benz didn't love the video part of the application.
Look, I hate to be on video, on camera, like, I avoid it.
But she says the $3,000 her bakery got from the fund was worth the performance anxiety. Ben says about half of her staff have been unable to get unemployment benefits.
So we've just been continuing to pay them 40 hours a week. So to me, that $3,000 covers a chunk of a 2-week payroll.
The Pennsylvania 30-Day Fund is actively soliciting both applicants and donations. The founders say they're hoping to keep the fund going for as long as it's needed. For Keystone Crossroads, I'm Miles Bryant.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Helen Wicker, Tom Hurley, Julia Zenkovich, Doug Schugerts, and Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.